also just to emphasize that it's a pity that we didn't have enough time the last time. So what we're going to do, we did post some questions, and we want to believe today we'll engage on those areas with Palama. So we'll do that first, and look at it, assess, and then if there are any issues as well, we'll just discuss it together, and then thereafter then we'll proceed with the program of action by the department. So if Parliament is ready, I think they can proceed. I would request that the leader of delegation introduces him or herself, and then the rest of the delegation, then they can proceed.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The Deputy Minister is heading the delegation for both Palama and the DPSA. But the Palama delegation is being led by the acting DG, Professor Molo. And I must also advise that he's got a very formidable team with him. And they've been working very hard to address your questions till 2 in the morning. I told them that they must not take note of the color of your coat. It doesn't mean anything other than that it meant to brighten a very dull day outside. But let me end the meeting with Professor Molo.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. And thank you, Chairperson and honorable members. I have with me the team, here Rupert Mutana, who is the branch head of provider and partner mobilization.
Rupert?
Okay. He's the one that I introduced as an ancestor and a colleague many years ago. And from government and support, I've got with me Ms. Mandy Samandis. Yes. And then we have from corporate finance, we have Carlo Canta. And then also from International Special Project, we have Dr. Sa Mukaya. Chairperson, as you have already said in your introduction, that our last encounter here last week, there were a number of questions that were asked by members of the committee. And I'll try and recap those areas that the questions were asked. And fundamental to those questions, we have grouped those questions in a set of about 6 areas of concern. The first area, which was very profound, was the issue of the transition of families to Palama, whether there were compliance issues and issues that pertain to the MINCOM recommendations, what the cabinet pronounced, and actually the real transition itself. The second area was the business model and its impact on training. Honourable Chair, the third question was Palama's procurement activities specific to the training. And the fourth area is Palama's performance, in particular women participation in management training. The fifth area was the financial surplus rollover that was asked by Honourable Member. The question also covered the grants, the donor-supported programs, and healthcare programs at Palama. Honourable Chairperson, I suggest that we deal with the first question, if you so allow, because then it lays the basis and it's an issue of transition from something to Palama. And I'm going to ask the ancestor, as I did last time, to take us through the first question.
Thank you very much, Chair and Deputy Minister DG. First of all, let me say that the question relating to the transition from Sambi to Palama it's a relevant question in the sense that certain chapters of our report contained in the annual report as outlined on page 11 of the annual report. Therefore, it is an appropriate question. But it also becomes an appropriate question because the transition from Swami to Palama informs our current form and our current business model. I want to start by saying, Chairperson, if you allow me, that this particular process of transition from Swami to Palama commenced in 2005. It commenced in 2005 as outlined in the annual report at the Cabinet Lokosha of July 2005. At that particular Cabinet Lokosha, the Minister of Public Service and Administration was mandated or requested by the Cabinet Lokosha to look at whether Swami, the then Swami, had the requisite capacity and capability to respond to the skills domain challenges within the public sector. And in answering that particular key question, which was relating broadly to the capacity of the state to deliver, the Minister of Public Service established the Ministerial Committee to assess this capacity of Swami as to whether it can live up to that particular expectation of supporting and delivering on capacity development within the public sector. The main BICOM report was constituted and it had various members in it, coming from government departments, coming from the private sector, coming from the organized labor, and also had an international expert in that particular membership, including members of higher education institutions, given the fact that higher education institutions are a stakeholder who work with Swami or who work with Swami and currently work with Palama on training and development. The MINCOM did its work, it was given a particular time frame in terms of reference to assess Swami. They followed a number of methodologies in gathering evidence, gathering information, including talking to the then Swami clients, talking to Swami itself, comparing international models, etc. And they came up with some kind of a summary finding. And if one were to highlight some of those findings, they found that Swami was not effectively fulfilling its mandate to provide quality, customized training for the development of the public sector. Therefore, in a nutshell, Swami was found to be wanting, both in terms of strategy, form, and quality of progress in responding to the skills challenges within the public sector. And they also came to a conclusion that if the Minister of Public Service then were to strengthen Swami, maybe give it more money or whatever, wouldn't have served the purpose. Because they noted that the mere strengthening of Swami in its current role will not address the problem identified. Therefore, they recommended that there has to be a new institution, academy, which should be established to lead and drive the capacity building initiatives within the public service as part and parcel of improving the provision of services to our citizens. But one of the critical elements which I believe relate to the question which was posed was how this particular process was going to be handled. And MINCOM was very categorical on this particular matter. They indicated that they acknowledged, first of all, that the implementation of the new academy was going to be a complex and challenging process. Therefore, they recommended an establishment of a task team. A task team comprising of people from outside to drive the implementation of this proposed academy. After that particular report, the report was submitted to the Minister of Public Services outlined in the annual report. The Minister of Public Service engaged with the report and ultimately presented the report and the findings, including the recommendations, to Cabinet in 2006. And Cabinet engaged with the report on the basis of the Cabinet memo which was presented and approved a number of recommendations, and some of those which I would like to highlight include the fact that Cabinet endorsed, in fact rather, they approved the Industrial Development Academy as a Schedule 1 department reporting to the Minister for Public Safety and Administration. I want to highlight on this particular one that this was some kind of a deviation, or rather an amendment, from the recommendation of MINCOM, because MINCOM had proposed the establishment of an agency with the board, and the board being appointed by the minister. But Cabinet felt that, given the fact that this particular entity will be supporting and working within the public service, they wanted to be a government department. Hence, now we've got Palama as a government department. But among other the things which were approved, they also endorsed the fact that there was supposed to be a task team to implement the academy over a period of 18 months. They also approved that there was supposed to be a parallel establishment of the new academy as opposed to family. They also endorsed the fact that the new academy needs to ensure, among other things, that they drive the development of common ethos and values for a professional public service, over and above a focus on practical management and leadership skills. The last part of this particular response now deals with how did then, or how was the cabinet decision implemented? First of all, the cabinet decision, the implementation of the cabinet decision was led by the DG, the former DG, obviously working in collaboration with the minister. 9 task teams were established within funding, looking at various focus areas like learning framework, training systems, etc. Thereafter, a business model was also developed, which was informed by a business shifting from becoming a provider to becoming a facilitator. And that particular shift was important, because it meant that the new academy was now moving away from a situation, the old some practice of having some kind of internal trainer, and having a situation whereby the trainers were now outsourced, or were brought from the outside. The second part, which was also a strategic shift, was moving from this idea of somebody of competing with other providers, where the new academy was supposed to collaborate with service providers who were seen as the delivery arm of training, rather than Palama being training itself. And then the last shift was the whole area of reaching a big number, that is bringing training to scale and to have relevant impact. That is, as you use several service providers, you'll be able to reach more numbers, and more numbers trained means a better impact on the public service. A new organogram was designed on the basis of that particular shift. There were also consultations with organized labor, the old sub-management, and before the advent to recruit people from the outside were placed on the print media, there was a process which we called matching and placing of Sandy staff. The old Sandy staff applied for positions in the new organogram. They were interviewed, they were subjected to committee assessment, and they were matched into this new organogram. Out of that particular process, 19 people were declared in excess, and thereafter, the remaining vacant positions were advertised in the print media, recruiting from the outside. Now the question which maybe the members, honorable members, may be interested in is to say, yes, there was the MINCOM report, yes, there was cabinet decision, and yes, there was implementation. What were the deviations? What were the gaps? Which probably may form part and parcel of how we move forward as Palama at the moment to strengthen our strategy and to ensure that we respond to the challenge of capacity building within the public sector. I would like to pause here, the Chair, and maybe I could get into the gaps once we maybe reflect on what I've just presented.
Okay, yeah, because actually, I just wanted to raise the fact that most of the time, when you're invited to appear before a committee in Parliament, what happens a Monday before, later, you send the documents that you're going to take up to them. And it's really, now we can hear you, but it's difficult for us to follow what you never send the documents. So, you know, part of why we want documents is because we make sure that we prepare before we come to these meetings with the other members of parliament. So that if the areas want to interrogate, we don't prolong this meeting unnecessarily. So part of not having documents, might I ask questions that we could have cleared ourselves. So I think it's difficult for us now to just follow without documents. I'm not sure why did Parliament choose not to give us documents. Is there a reason for that?
Honourable Chairperson, the report was saying this is the annual report that we presented. And the invitation that we received from Parliament was the discussion emanating from the questions that were asked. Hence, it was because there were questions that were asked, there was no... If one looks at the invitation, for example, when you check the Department of Public Service and Administration, it specifically says the program. But this, to us, it was a continuation of a discussion, of a presentation and a document that we submitted last week, based on the annual report. This was our annual report. But there were no proper guidelines.
Okay, sorry, I don't think we understand one another. We're actually saying you're coming to respond. You knew from yesterday when we left this meeting that you are requested for responses on those issues. So you weren't prepared for those responses, but you don't give them to us. For instance, do we have anything to refer for now in terms of what you are actually talking about? No, because normally we work on documentation as well, so that it serves us like that. We'd be asking questions, you know, thinking, you know, we are not here. I don't think we are that we can capture things as they are. Because my opinion is that at least even if before this you could have, I heard you outlining the areas, you knew them so well, and I'm sure you've worked on those areas.
Honorable Chair, there was a MINCOM report. It was sent on Monday, isn't it? Monday. It was sent the executive summary of the MINCOM report, what he is actually presenting on. It was sent to the committee on Monday. It is the same report that is...
We really don't work that way. We actually don't really work that way. You know, because members are going to actually ask me when we are gone, like, how do we interact? You know, because you can't actually, this report, you can't say in the basis of this is the point of reference. Okay, proceed.
Can I talk on what they've talked about? I was taking notes, so, I mean, that's it. Okay, I just want to know, there was this MINCOM that recommended that an agency be established in the new structure, and then Cabinet came with a Schedule 1 government department. Now, that decision, has anybody looked at whether it had been an agency, whether it would have been more effective, or you know what I'm saying? There's quite a big difference between those two structures. And has that affected the performance? You know, obviously the MINCOM recommendation was based, you said the MINCOM was consisted of many different stakeholders and experts and things, and then Cabinet came with a different decision. And I'd just like to know whether or not you think that, I'm not saying that it's a mistake, I'm just saying why was there such a big difference between those two recommendations on the actual, the structure of Paloma?
Okay, can I request the Parliament to proceed at least to cover all those areas and then come back to the question and other questions that will be asked?
Thanks, Chairperson. The last input on this particular I just want to highlight a few of the deviations or amendments which were effected, one by the deviations from the MINCOM recommendations, and also some deviations from the Cabinet decision. The first one, as you correctly pointed out, was this shift from being an agency to becoming a department. That was an amendment from Cabinet, and that was a mandate on which we worked on as we implemented the new academy as a department mandated by Cabinet. The second deviation from the MINCOM recommendation, MINCOM recommended some kind of internal quality assurance with some kind of a peer review mechanism. And we deviated from that because we felt that the legislation in South Africa governing training and development, like SAPA and skills development, therefore the accreditation and quality assurance issues needed to be aligned to those South African governments. Like, for instance, as we speak at the moment, we are created through the PCSA, which is the legal requirement. Because the MINCOM recommended that maybe we needed to have quite internal quality assurance and later get an ETGA center, which was a problem. The last deviation, as far as MINCOM was concerned, they recommended that the new academy should be fully funded, at least initially, and then later on to have some element of cost recovery. And that we deviated from, given the fact that we are not fully funded, therefore we continued with cost recovery. Those are the three key ones from MINCOM. But from the cabinet side, one, the cabinet approved the establishment of the task team for implementation of the academy with external people. But the implementation of the academy was led by the former DG as a driver of the implementation with internal task teams within Palama rather than a task team comprising external people. The second part was this outsourced capacity for training. The cabinet did not make a specific call on this matter, but they called for insertion of an academy. And my interpretation of that particular instance of academy, I'm expecting some kind of internal capacity for training, but on this particular one, to cover more numbers and also to have scale and impact, we relied on external training providers. And then lastly, initially the academy was to be established parallel to SAMDI, but in this particular implementation process, SAMDI left the academy was established within SAMDI. Therefore, there was no parallel running of the two institutions before the transition was completed. Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to proceed? Do you want to proceed to other questions? Or would you prefer that we engage now? Members can proceed.
I wanted him to complete the deviation as we observed it, because the question also went into our own analysis.
Yeah.
So if you can complete the deviation from there, then we can engage the first part of your question.
I think you don't understand one another again. So you actually said, where are we now? So where did you divert and what is the current status? Where did we actually work well, or where are we on track? So that's the final part of the question.
Yes, thanks, Chair, and thanks for clarifying. I think at the moment, as we are quite aware, the academy has been established with the new program and particular business model. One could say that the transition from family to Palama is complete. That transition happened. The academy is up and running, is providing programs with its own business model. What is needed now, under the leadership of the DG and the ministers, is we'll be embarking on a strategic planning process, which will be responding to the challenge posed to us about the further transformation of Palam, which relates to issues of strategy and mainly. But one will be the presumption if one were to anticipate as to what would be the outcome of the comprehensive strategic planning process, which will be impacting on under the leadership of the DG.
Prof. Mayor, do you want to also touch that element, perhaps?
President, one acknowledges that there's a transition that took place, a migration from the old family into Palama. During the transition, I mean, the business model was implemented, and we'll cover the second, the business case as it was developed. But I think there are a number of lessons that will come out when we deal with the business model. For an example, of a capacity that we lost especially because everything became possible. And it's one of the lessons, and as we engage on a further transformation of Panama, we sit back and say, these were the areas in which we really have to bring in capacity inside. Obviously, for focus effectiveness, because we also acknowledge that the model of outsourcing has been very costly. That's one area. But those areas of, we will, if members don't have questions on the transition, because this transition itself produced a different business model. And the implications of this particular model, if you allow Chairperson, is what I was going to ask, that he present the business model that we have, and then we'll then see the implications. And secondly, Chairperson, we have requested that the copies that we have of the documents we have be copied for the members, and we humbly really apologize for not having it. I think there was a serious misunderstanding of our policy.
To continue
with the business model and
his impact on training. Thank you, DG. Thanks, Chair. The business model of Palama was informed by the three strategy shifts which I highlighted, mainly moving from being a provider to facilitating training, that is, facilitating other providers to provide training on its behalf. And again, ensuring that there's no competition between Palama and other service providers, that these service providers should work under Palama as delivery arms. But the last one was also the whole issue of trying to make available, make training available to as many public servants as possible so that we can have an impact, which led to the whole the caption of massification of training. Therefore, on that particular basis, there were three categories of what we call them service providers for training. One big category was the higher education institutions. They are seen as partners, but they are also seen as service providers of training. And they derive the materials with Palama, and they deliver the training on behalf of Palama. And we've got about 300 facilitators or trainers from these high education institutions. But the high education institutions are important because they also provide accreditation or credits to some of the programs we are offering. That's one group. The second group is the what we call independent individual contractors. These are individual trainers from the market out there in the private sector. We recruit them through outlets, we interview them, and then thereafter we also induct them. And we've got 125 of those individuals who have been training on behalf of Palama across the country. They are not on our payroll. We pay them per delivery, and as depending on how many sessions they train per month or so. So that is the second group, individual. The last group are the private companies. These are companies who tender for work of training within Palama, and they do training on our behalf. In some cases, they also use their own material, which means that they need to be customized for the public sector. In this particular category, the third category, we've got five companies who are involved here. And I've got details of these the companies, maybe if the chairperson allows me to show them on the screen.
Just to try, they just have to be there. And there's no competition between
Thanks, Chair, for allowing me to get my bearings. This is what I've just presented, the summary of the types of training providers, the 125 individuals covering junior, JMMS stands for junior and middle management service members, and the SMS senior management members. And then private companies, as I indicated, we've got five companies. Their names are right at the bottom there. We've got Lemark Training and Development Company, Regenesis, though it's a private institution, is a company, Africa International Advisors, Assessment College of South Africa, and Helen Berger and Associates. And then in terms of universities, we've got 9 for junior staff, universities involved, and then 12 for SMS. And then the last bullet there, number 4 under notes, highlights the fact that the total number of facilitators located within the universities are 300 who are doing work for Palama. Therefore, if we were to do headcount, we will say we've got over 400 facilitators doing work for Palama on any given year. The next slide basically outlines the way we go about recruiting them and what we are looking for when we recruit them. Like in the case of individuals, we look for technical expertise, public sector knowledge and experience in particular fields. Like if you talk about financial management, we look for those kind of people. And then we contract them in line with the Tax Act. We also ensure that before we send them on the ground to train, we provide that training of trainers or induction training program. And the contract which we give them are normally 1 year. And we've got a clause in the contract which indicates that we can terminate the contract if the training provider is not, or is experiencing challenges in terms of living up to our standards. This is an important slide, Chair, given the fact that it gives us a breakdown of the geographic spread of our individual trainers, but it also gives us a breakdown in terms of gender and race. They are all 125 right at the bottom there, at the bottom corner, 125 individuals. 54.8% of them are black individuals, 49.6 are female, and this slide also shows where we are not doing well in terms of the geographic spread, like provinces Mpumalanga, Free State, and Northern Cape, where we are not doing well in terms of the individual. The next slide, Chair, gives us categories of the high education institutions, that is universities, the regions within which they are working, that is the national departments, Northern Region, Central Region, and Southern. And we've got two categories of their offerings, that is SMS and JMMS. The bolded names of universities illustrate the lead university of that particular consortium. Like in the case of the national departments, the Val University of Technology leads that particular consortium, with Free State, Delhi University, and Central University being members of the consortium. This is just an illustration of how we categorize these universities in terms of regions. This was an important shift in the sense that previously, in the old time, we used to issue tenders to these universities, and it was a winner-take-all. Like University of Stellenbosch or University of Pretoria will win a tender and they'll train from Limpopo to Eastern Cape nationally. Then we decided to say that it's not good for the participant, for the learner herself, because these programs contain credits. therefore is in risk of Limpopo on a tender, and the person wants to claim that particular claim based in Eastern Cape. It would be a challenge for that particular lemma to claim those claims. And knowing that our investors are still in this competition mode, even though they in some cases they're not related. This is the breakdown, the chair, of the individual facilitators within the universities. 300 of them, 49% of them are black, 60% of them are female, and this slide also illustrates the predominance of facilitators from the lead universities. Like, for instance, if you take the University of Pretoria, the lead university, the top is having more facilitators in that particular category more than the compared to the partners, Limpopo, Swani, and UNISA. The same applies to some extent the University of Forte, number 9, having more facilitators as compared to its partner, University of Western Cape. These are the private companies we are using, and even the facilitators they are having there. They're in total, they've got 30 facilitators, 46% of them being black, 40% being female. One thing which one needs to highlight on this particular slide, or as far as these providers are concerned, is the fact that most of the materials which are used by these private companies, the copyright is owned by them, as opposed to the copyright of the materials used by individuals. It's owned by Palama. The same applies to copyright of the materials used by universities, which were developed between Palama and universities. The copyright resides with Palama. But here, the provider brings its own material. They just customize the specification of Palama and roll it out. And the contract of these service providers come in three forms. The individuals is period based, like 20 or 18 months. In the private companies, it's normally value based. We'll give them maybe 2 million contract or a 1 million contract. And in higher education institutions, it's again value based, depending on the phases of the particular program. This slide, the chair, was just an additional slide which we also shared with the minister to show that over and above the training providers, which are in the form of individuals, universities, and private companies, we also have partnerships within government or within the public service who are helping us to ensure that we comply in terms of accreditation, in terms of quality of our programs, etc. But also who are helping us to implement key programs like the induction program. The induction program, though developed by Palama, the rollout is done by departments themselves using their own internal trainers or using trainers in academies of provinces where these academies exist. Therefore, the partnerships are also important over and above the contracting of the service program. And this last slide gives us a synopsis of the way we are going about it. In terms of individuals, we advertise, we go through a selection process, and then thereafter we TOT or induct the providers. But in terms of companies, and there's a competitive bidding process where they respond to terms of reference, and then thereafter get a contract within Palama. But for universities, we call all of them to a brief session. We brief them about the way we categorize the regions. We also encourage them to work as a consortium rather than as an individual institution. Thank you, Chair. If I may pause here, maybe.
Thanks. I think we still have other parts, right? Maybe let's address this part. If there are no other issues to be raised on this area. Palama, I'm sure you're through with this one.
Yes,
Yeah, the only outstanding one, which is one of the implications, is the question that was raised in terms of Panama's performance. Before we go to the financial model, the performance of women. And just one slide. And I humbly request that if we could just show them the slide of women, then we'll be done with this part of women.
Okay.
And then we'll go into the financial one, and then we'll deal with the dollar.
In the last engagement, Chair, there was a question we made in our honor report. We are stating that over the last financial year, we trained more women than men on management programs. And the honorable members were asking a question to say that when we say more, how much? What is the percentage? What are the numbers? And then here we went back into our database. We looked at the total number of women trained in management development programs. We trained 10,791, and then we trained 9,476 men, which represents 47%, and then women 53% of the management training which took place over the last year. What we did not do, Chair, I need to acknowledge this, is the fact that we did not break it down per program, per management program. But in the current year, we have developed a field in our training management system where we can track the training of women per program on management development, so that we can be able to tell that X number of women were trained on either foundation management or emerging managers program or advanced management development program or senior management program. As a woman, we just lump them together as management development program for women and for men.
I'm sure now we can proceed to any areas that members want to engage with based on the presentation. You did right. Okay. Honorable Dikani, please.
Good morning. Chairperson, I'm not really impressed with this. I don't know. Sorry, Sarah. I've got a, I don't know, I might be asking questions in between because perhaps it would be a follow-up to some of the issues I'm going to mention. But I want to give an overall impression about this Panama thing, that we need to perhaps re-look into the relevance of Panama within the requirements of our present legislation. In terms of skills development in particular, which I don't hear you really talking about issues around skills development in terms of the skills audit and so on. So as a result, it tempts me to ask the question, Palama, are you a consultancy? Are you operating like a consultancy and nothing else? Because if you come to training departments in particular in government, because you say you are rendering a service to the public service, there are training institutions, there are training areas that you even find in some of the towns having the premier's office, for example, having a training department, you know. And I don't see your connection between these departments and yourselves. And with all these monies that you are seeing, for example, if you look at the one,
color.
I don't know what to call it, what is it?
Color one.
The, this financial performance report, when you look at the way you cost, it's definitely not aligned to the way normal costing would be indicated in terms of training in skills development, for example, which says to me, you don't go through processes of the skills audit, you don't go through the process of the workplace skills plan, completing that workplace skills plan, you don't go through the process of actually having learners inside your own building. If I can put it in a simple language, that I would have expected the people should be coming to your building Instead, if you look at the issue of cost of sales, where you are spending money, to spend an amount on traveling and stationery of 16.697, is that 16 million that I'm looking at? You are servicing yourself and not the targeted people that you're supposed to be training. How much money is going out to people who are being paid in terms of your, you said you've got categories of service providers. Those monies are going out to those people. The concern is more on the operations, your own operations, and the service providers you have to pay. But there's absolutely no indication of the people who are trained. You know, what value are we getting out of the people who have been trained for government? I'm looking at the fact that you mentioned something like the Genesis or something, there being private companies, monies are going there. How are those benefiting us? All the people who are going for training. To me, I don't know, Chair, it's unfortunate that I'm getting this feeling now, but it gives me the impression that as a committee we need to go back, re-look into the issues of Palama and their alignment, because most of your operations are parallel to what is being done by departments, training departments in government. And there's no one body that you can see that has been trained. If we had to speak essence to your presentation as an academy, as we are saying at a leadership academy, management academy, there's no one body that you are seeing has actually been good results of what we'd want to see out of government. You're very graph about the women and men. Fine, you can see what's happening there. But it doesn't talk to the issue of how many women are improving or are taking up leadership positions, having had the relevant training that is needed, because most of them need that training. We come from an experience where we know that women were not really exposed to these things, and they are faced with being professionals now, and when they get into this professional world, they don't have opportunities to train unless they were people who could afford to take themselves to school. You don't see that picture. It's not that, or it's almost as if you're just moving in your own direction that is far away from us. You are almost government, but not quite government. You know, when you talk real human resource development, it's not there, guys. It's not there in terms of Palama, which leaves me once again with the query, are you a consultancy? And how relevant are you in terms of being a part of the structure?
Okay,
thank you, Chair.
I'll come to you, remember, but also and yourself. Now I've got two DGs, Palama, and I want to recognize one of them, but anyway, I'll say that one, acting, okay, not the acting one in this case. There was a two DGs in this case. Oh, okay, and Prof. Levine, you'll come after another some scouting. You come?
No. Thank you. Okay, sorry, I've just got some questions in a similar line from the previous speaker. I'd like to know, does Palama know which are the scarce skills in the public sector and which are the most needed skills in the public sector, and how do you know what the training needs are? Because there's nothing there about finding out what the training needs are in order for government to implement our five-year plan, government's five-year plan, as in the State of the Nation address, etc. There doesn't seem to be any way that you know this, or do you just train when you ask to train? If a section of public sector says we need training on project management, then you just train project management. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. There was an oral question put to the Minister of Public Service, Mr. Aloy, in connection with outside consultants which are being used to do the duties that the public service actually have to do. Now, I want to connect with your remark. Does that not reflect negatively on the work Palama is supposed to do? Training public servants to do their work. The fact that so many outside consultants at very high cost are being used in the public service, does that reflect negatively, or am I wrong?
Okay. And Prof. Levine?
Chairperson, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I'm not sure if normally I would engage in a discussion like this, but listening to the honourable members, I did think it would be important to say that I sat on the ministerial committee, and it might be useful to articulate the vision which those of us who sat on the committee had in relation to what has since unfolded. I think the key problem statement, as it were, when we sat on that committee, is that there's a huge gap between the knowledge that public servants gain in universities or universities of technology or training institutes of various kinds, between that knowledge and the skills requirements of service delivery in the public service. I think that's the gap we identified. When we were in the Public Service Commission, in I think 2001 or 2002, we began a process of auditing qualifications. And we found that the public service is very highly qualified. We have many people with 2 degrees in the public service. So what is the problem? And that is the kind of gap we're referring to. People come with a lot of knowledge, but how to translate that knowledge into the skills which are required to get service delivery going is the gap we identified. And our vision, as those of us sitting on the committee, is that SAMD would transform itself into a training institution or training academy which would fill this particular gap. And ultimately, I think we also had as part of our vision, and we did some comparative research and we engaged intensively with experts from other countries, including India. We wanted a situation, and obviously it could not be in the short term, where new entrants to the public service would actually have to pass exams. They would have to go through a training program and pass exams, which should certify that they indeed have the necessary skills to discharge their responsibilities. And even for progression, because we were concerned that there's too much mobility, people move too fast inside the public service through promotions, applying for other jobs, and so on, that there would need to be qualifications or examinations which they would public servants would need to pass in order to progress to a higher level. One of the key challenges was the issue of capacity, and I think this relates to the kind of model that you are interrogating as the committee. Our view was that we needed to draw on 3 sources to capacitate SAMD going forward into the future. The one was obviously to build internal capacity. But the second was to recognize that there are many people in the public service, in the senior management service, for example, and probably even in the middle management service, who could be competent trainers or lecturers. And as part of their service, they would need to present modules and courses within SAMD or Palama to boost the capacity. And that would be an ongoing thing, because I think it's logical. It makes sense. We're in the public service. We've got the capacity to train. Why can't we, as part of our roles and responsibilities, implement courses? So, and then the third source would be in-source, not outsource, in-source. Bring in key lecturers or teachers or whatever from existing training institutes, but bring them in to in-source that capacity in order to be able to implement the full training program of a transformed SAMD. Of course, there are other mechanisms and policy instruments which we've come up with DPSA, including the revolving door, which would allow an interface between universities and the public service utilize the skills of people in universities and universities of technology and training institutes and so on. But I thought it would be important, Chairperson, I hope I'm not out of order, to just share that vision which we had as part of the MINCOM, because I think it does show that there is a big gap between the vision as we articulated it and the model that was developed. Thank you very much.
Okay. Do you still need your response from can we move to other areas? I think we are appreciating that the discussion is maturing, and of course it actually clarifies to us what are the areas that we want to move in, particularly the committee moving forward. I think if members allow me, another from Stanley, maybe let me allow them to finalize. You know, I'm considering now that we're taking much time, but we have to, you know, because this issue is very critical. We definitely have to look into it quite in detail. So can we just finalize so that you don't have, I know that other areas are not really much. It's just a matter of some few slides. Let's finalize so that when we want to engage on any other area, there is no presentation that will be done. I know that there's not much as well from the presentation. Okay.
And the next area will be the financial rollover, and the last area will be the dollar money. Carlos will do the financial.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, members. On the rollover, the question was posed on 62 million, but I just need to clarify that it was actually 52 million rand that we've got as left as rollovers in our surplus fund and the trading entity, which will then be utilized for our priority areas. Such as the presidential induction program, own systems development, and learner management systems, etc. That's what the 52 million rand, it's in our annual report. Give you the page. It's set out on page 127 of our annual report, the 52 million for the 08-09 period. Which that will be then utilized for. On the other areas of the questions posed, the one was the table on the donor funds, which I just need to highlight again, is that the table starts with a receipt in cash. So we've got our local aid assistance, the Renaissance Fund, which costs our opening balance, the revenue received, and less the expenditure then gives us our closing balance. Our aid assistance from our foreign aid assistance is broken down between aid assistance unutilized and our aid assistance receivable. The first line is the sum of the total of the four projects. So the 28 would be the sum of the 192, and then the 28. That line will be made up. So that's just the sum of, and then it costs across as our opening balance plus what we receive, less our expenditure, then gives us the closing balance. And the same will happen with our aid assistance receivable as well. The 1 plus the 249 gives us the 250. That then adds up to our foreign aid assistance received in cash, would then be the sum of the 28 and the 250 that makes up the negative 222. That would be the same for our revenue received, the expenditure, and then our closing balance. And then our total aid received in cash would then be the 22 plus 0, the 10.7 plus the 23 that will then give us the 34 less the 17 that leaves us with a balance of 16.5. Needed to clear that on the table, which was unclear. On the next issue that was raised by Honourable Resource was our analysis of our tolerance of expenditure. What we've done here is to actually, based on the number of PTDs that we've trained for the year, to break down our income and our expenditure per PTD, per person trained. Which then our income for the year was 131 million, which was made up of our revenue for training and the transfer that we received from Parliament, which the 89 plus the 42 then gives us the 131 million. That relates to 982 rand per PTD that we then received in revenue. Our cost of sales, which is our cost of delivering the training, unfortunately, the other travel and stationery is not exhaustive. There's actually printing, there's materials that's also included in there. which makes up for the delivery of the trains. So that is what's paid for trainers to get to venues and to then to deliver on the trains. The 16 plus the 50 plus the 16 then gives us the 83 million of our direct costs that we've then paid to deliver on the training, which results in 620 rand per PTD that was trained. Our contribution is the net of the 131 million less the 83, gives us the 48.6 million, which results in 362 rand per PTD trained. Our operating cost on that slide then shows us what is it costing our the organization to be run. That's our internal cost. Our staff cost, which is the salaries of our own internal people. Our administrative costs for our building, our other operating costs, our staff development costs, our audit costs, our travel, our own printing station for the department itself. That all adds up to 53 million rand, and that's 401 rand per PTD trained. And that then results back into our net effect for the surplus of the year of 1.8 million, which is only 14 rand per person trained. So our expenditure tolerance level is actually, if we look at our direct cost of training and what's left over, it's based on a model of cost plus 40. It almost works out that we're retaining about 40% of what we then need to cover our own internal cost for. So we're almost in line with the way the model was set up to work.
Okay. Can we then proceed?
Then we'll go to the dollar funding issue.
Okay.
Honorable Chair, members of the committee, I think the question related to the donor funding is what frames our donor partnership. And also, what kinds of agreements do we have? Country agreements, institutional agreements, and how exactly do those happen? Firstly, what Kalama does is it seeks, it utilizes donor funding only as seed capital for areas of innovation, and so not normally for the normal programs of training and development within Kalama. And we do this work in conjunction with the National Treasury Regulations. So the ODA policy, which is the official donor assistance policy, frames the way in which we work with donors. And that is based mainly on the Paris Declaration of 2005, which the principal tenets ensure that we have ownership, that what we do is aligned to our country's strategy. Also that there's accountability, mutual accountability on both sides. We also work on a results-based model in terms of how we do this. And most importantly, we ensure that there's harmonization among the donors that we work with, that there isn't replication or... I think Treasury's role is to make sure that donors don't confuse departments that do seek donor assistance in their programs. So, and this happens through the annual consultations. Every year, Treasury has annual consultations with all the key donors, and we as departments attend those meetings and talk about identification of programs that are match our priorities as departments or our strategies, and also look at where the sources for possible funding is in areas of innovation that we might be seeking funding for. In terms of the agreement, normally there's a country agreement between the two countries, MOUs, that then determine the kind of scope for the collaboration between the two countries. And that's normally in Article 2 or 3 of the MOUs. And in terms of that, there may be or may not be a ministerial MOU between the like the Ministry of Public Services here and the Ministry of Public Services in another country that we work with. And then based on that if we do secure a donor contract and there are partner institutions that we work with as an institution, we then put in place SLA, service level agreements, or institutional agreements as well. Now, to give you an example of this, we did get a small amount of funding from the Royal Netherlands a little while ago when we realized that Palama's or Sandy's programs then did not target local government training, and we could see that that would become an area that's of need. So we did a little pilot where we're currently looking at about 300 municipal managers in three provinces, and so this is a small number, but the idea here was to try and customize Palama's programs for training at that level. Currently our programs have always started with national and provincial managers, and so the competences are different for national level to local government level. So we use the seed funding to customize curriculum and develop training courses for the local government level. We're in the process now, next year we will deliver those courses. And there we have had service level agreements between Palama and the provincial governments to move with that kind of program. So that's one example, please.
Okay, I don't know, is there any other thing that you need to raise? Because what we'll do now is just suggest a process. A process, okay. Yeah, Palama, thanks for the presentation, thanks for coming back and doing the responses. As this committee definitely has a lot of interest in what Palama is doing, how Palama has to move forward. And of course, we realize that we really that we accept that, okay, you did a presentation, but there's many things are still wanting at this point in time. And as this committee, we are developing a program to engage with you. We will do follow-up. We have agreed that the very first follow-up, we would really want to come to Palama. And like I indicated last, for us, training in theory, it's not tangible. You really need to see some of the training programs. But also, something that is very critical is the strategy in terms of moving forward, which we have the instance of the team. It's a little bit wanting, I'm sure we all agree. And we want to allow you space and time to actually deal with it. And then we want to believe the time we start to move in engaging with you in terms of how you implement, how you move forward. We will be part of this committee. So we will actually give you the program of how we're going to interact with you moving forward. Mm-hmm. And we want to hope and believe that we'll work on those events from now onwards up to the time that's not very long, we'll be interacting. We'll inform the department together with yourself. Thank you very much. Okay. Ms. Levin, we want to move to the next presentation. If you can, should we allow the next session? Are you tired? Okay, we can take a 5 minute rest and then just five, then we can proceed.
So this is the beginning of the process, and I think there's an opportunity here for the committee to engage with and to reshape how they further transform Palama. What you're getting right now is what has happened.
Okay.
So you can't change yesterday.
Yes.
You can change tomorrow.
Okay. So they deviated completely.
Yeah. Well, not completely. There's been some. I mean, they've been attempting to make the transformation, and with that has come a lot of distortion.
Yes, yes, I can see. Yeah.
So it's now to get them back on the track. That's where there's an opportunity for the committee.
Yes.
To enter into a partnership with them. Not a watchdog role, but what do you call it? Advocate. Yeah.
What is this? He cited in the committee process further and further.
Into the, after the evening.
Because essentially it should conclude on Friday.
Why is he? He loves the thing. He will not be ready for the financial
thing. I think it's more like sort of just trying to get some more time so that the report could be better.
Next to her is Vanessa Pala. Lavasalian Mulbagesh is from the ministry. Mr. Peter Mufukeng, Mr. Dumisani and Kwamba, and Mr. Kuben Governor. And on the other side, we have Ms. Shamila Abrams, who is the parliamentary officer in the department. So the main interface, she's been on maternity leave, but she's come back now. So I'm sure you'll be interacting with her. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll just give a very brief overview and then I'll go through the program and then I'll ask the various program managers to deal with the four areas that you asked us to focus specifically on, which is anti-corruption, the Chuseong Centers, the community development workers, and gender and disability. Just to indicate that the DPSA established an anti-corruption unit in 2001, and this mainly flowed from discussions with the Public Service Commission after the first National Anti-Corruption Conference. But the DPSA did develop a public service anti-corruption strategy in 2002, and subsequently conducted an impact appraisal, which will inform future work in anti-corruption. We're also finalizing an integrity management framework, which seeks to guide anti-corruption efforts of government, business, and civil society. It will also address existing gaps in the current conflict of interest framework. and introduce ethics officers in departments. There's also a major training program with 20 million in donor, 20 million rand in donor support, which has been developed. A number of courses have been developed, and the first course will commence in February 2010. The Tucson Service Centers are an initiative of the Government Communication and Information Service, the GCIS, and the intention, as we know, is to establish one Tucson Center per municipality by 2014. Currently, we have 140 operational Tucson Centers, which are located in poor, urban, and remote rural areas. And we really wanted to create a one-stop service center where people could obtain a number of services in one place. And these would typically be home affairs, social development, labor, as well as provincial and municipal services. They're very remote in many cases, and they don't easily have access to internet connectivity. And not all have general service counters, which enable citizens to access the internet and the Batu PD government services portal. And our presentation will be focusing primarily on that aspect, because this is a key role of the DPSA in the initiative. As we know, the community development workers were pioneered in 2003 by the DPSA. Provincial capacity was established, and currently we have 3,146 PDWs operating in all provinces. There have been challenges in some of the areas where PDWs were sometimes misconstrued as being political agents. We have endeavored to clarify the roles of PDWs with respect to councillors, ward committees, and for the most part, the CDWs operate at the municipal level. Last year, our gender and disability program received a major boost when the Gender Equality and Job Access Strategic Framework, which guides departments on how to boost representativity and remove discriminatory practices, were approved. The representativity which we'll look at is not meeting the targets with respect to women in senior management, standing at 35% as opposed to 50%. We've reported that before, and disability as well, currently at 0.2%, short of the target by a long way, the target being 2%. Now, I think the presentation which we're going to go into now will show that we have prioritized these programs which have been identified by the portfolio committee. But let me just run through the first part very quickly so that the program managers can get into the details which I've outlined. Maybe just to start, Honourable Chairperson, by clarifying the planning cycle of government. Strategic planning is normally undertaken during June and July in order to prepare for the submission of the medium-term expenditure framework to National Treasury in August. Then we need to, the next step is preparing the estimates of national expenditure. That's the phase we're currently in, which will guide our program for next year. And then we go into detailed operational planning during February and March. And then the strategic plan, as we know, is tabled before the debate on the budget, which normally is between March and June. And the commencement of the financial year is April to March. I say this, Honourable Chairperson, because largely what we're presenting today is based on the strategic plan. We are, as I've indicated, preparing our estimates of national expenditure, and then we'll go into more detailed operational planning. So the first slide just goes through the various programs, and I'll just cover the project areas. I won't necessarily go for the outputs and deliverables. There might be questions which the honourable members have which we could clarify. In human resource management and development, the monitoring framework and tool have been finalized and implemented. This is with respect to human resource development. the establishment of human resource development forums at provincial, national, and sector levels, and the policy on compulsory training programs for HR practitioners. The development of a strategic framework for youth development in the public service. The HR Connect implementation rollout, I think in terms of the questions raised by some of the honorable members during the Palama part of the meeting, would maybe necessitate at some stage that we talk more about this skills audit process that we developed through the HR Connect. And then the development of the guideline for institutional support programs for engagement. In management of compensation, we have the review of pension and medical provisioning in the public service, which will focus on post-retirement medical assistance. Then the implementation of the HR module of the IFMS, the Integrated Financial Management System, is a massive initiative of the National Treasury, which focuses on supply chain management, financial management, and HR management. And we are responsible for the HR module, the human resource module. And hopefully, over time, it will give us much better HR information, which will be interoperable with financial information. Then strengthening a social partnership for good governance. The main initiative here will be the public sector summit. And then monitoring and evaluation of wasteful trends in the public service. And the implementation of a remuneration policy framework of the single public service, which obviously is a matter we will be engaging the community in depth in the months and year to come. Then the design and implementation of the Single Public Service Change Management Program and the development of a pilot urban mall at the Maponya Mall. This is something that we will talk to when we engage in the Tucson Service Center part of the presentation. On information and technology management, the IT blueprint, the architecture blueprint for IT and government. We've got a major project going now on information security. And then also a major area of work is support for the government IT Officer Council, with the secretariat being provided by the Department of Public Service and Administration. Then our focus on e-government, the prototype we're in the process of developing to enable 6 appropriate services, which are listed: application for ID, childbirth registration, foster care grant, application for pension, application for maintenance and notification of death, and then the Tucson Service Center connectivity, which we will be speaking to in greater depth. Service delivery improvements, the Dr. Pili Change Management Engagement Program, the committee has engaged us on this matter in our previous engagement on the annual report and asked a number of pertinent questions there. Then we are also providing support in the implementation of the War on Poverty campaign, which is led from the presidency. And then coordination and facilitation of learning and knowledge management platforms and products in the public service. The publication of the Service Delivery Review Journal, and then the support for the DRC Census of Public Service project. In the area of governance, the program, the second minimum anti-corruption capacity compliance audit, the public sector anti-corruption capacity building program, and phase 2 of the OECD anti-corruption convention. The enforcement and monitoring task team is something that we have engaged the committee before when we had to engage around the Auditor General's report and what the department, what role the department is playing in dealing with the requirements flowing out of the Auditor General's report. The anti-corruption training program for business and support to the DRC implementation of the Memorandum of Understanding that is supporting the DRC in their anti-corruption summit and development of their strategy. So, Chairperson, that was just an outline of our program for next year. as requested, and we'll then go into the special focus areas that have been requested, beginning with anti-corruption, and Vanessa Pala will be leading us on that one. Thank you.
Thank you, TG, and thank you, Chair. With regard to anti-corruption, the first project is the implementation of the second national anti-corruption program. This is the program that emanated from the first national anti-corruption summit, which was held in August 2008. And this is the initiative of government, business, and civil society. And secondly, the implementation of the recommendations of the anti-corruption impact appraisal that was also concluded this year. And the compliance audit report on the implementation of the MEC requirements at national and provincial departments. We are conducting an audit of the minimum anti-corruption capacity requirements at both national and provincial departments to assess the level of compliance. And also the rollout of the anti-corruption capacity building program at both national and provincial departments. And also in terms of the implementation of the business anti-corruption training program, this is the program that we are implementing jointly with BUSA, the Business Unit of South Africa. And also the monitoring and enforcement of conflict of interest measures. And this we do through the public sector integrity management framework, which DG highlighted. Furthermore, also the other project is the anti-corruption communication training and awareness program, which we are doing in collaboration with FUSA, but also with collaboration within the broader NSDF framework. And also development and implementation of the anti-corruption framework for the DRC. This is the broader implementation of the trilateral MOU between South Africa, the UNODC, and the DRC. And the implementation and monitoring of the public service integrity management framework, which then addresses the broader issues of conflict of interest. And also the implementation and hosting of the anti-corruption management information system that will therefore allow us to do an analysis of anti-corruption of corruption cases that have been reported by departments. And also continuous participation in the OECD Anti-Corruption Convention Working Group for the implementation of the Anti-Bribery Convention. And with regard to the budget, for the financial year 2010-2011, it was 3,194,000, 2011-2012, 3,170,000, and 2012-2013, 3,325,000. I'll go back to the DG.
Michelle Williams.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. The Food Center program, I think, as we've emphasized, has historically been led by the Minister in the Presidency. And the responsibility for coordinating the Food Centers has essentially resided with the GCIS. As I mentioned in the one workshop, there are two strands that converge with the establishment of what we call the multipurpose community centers. And I've always said in my engagement with colleagues that it's not a coincidence that we have the lack of government infrastructure in rural and remote areas. These rural and remote areas typically tend to be what was formerly the TBBC states and the self-governing territories, rather than the old white South Africa, where you had municipalities. And those municipalities evolved around a certain blueprint, whereas the provision of services in rural and remote areas did not conform to a specific blueprint. Post-1994, as we try to extend services to communities in rural and remote areas, the concept of a multipurpose community centers evolved, and the notion of the one-stop shop, where instead of having to go in different directions to access different services, citizens could go to one place and collect a pension, access services from police or from clinic, or instead of going in a lot of different directions, and of course them being the poorest of the poor, and transport not being readily available in those areas. That program was kicked off when the first Tusong Center was launched in 1998 in a village called Tombo in the Eastern Cape. And that area didn't have telecommunication infrastructure. In fact, MTN put in one of the first masks in that area to provide connectivity to the DOC initiative, which was called the Telecenter program. And I'm sure members are familiar with the Telecenter. What we didn't do in 1998, when we placed government departments in those multi-purpose community centers, is provide connectivity to the government departments. So even though the DOC piloted the telecenters, which were to provide computer access, email and internet access for the public, the government departments that were resident in those centers did not have connectivity. In fact, even today, there are many Tusong centers where government departments don't have access to a telephone. So when we talk about the connectivity of Tusong centers, we talk about the second generation of connectivity for Tusong centers. And you will see here that the GPSA projects are categorized as install and maintain internet connectivity, but I just wanted the committee to understand the distinction that we're making with the second generation connectivity initiatives that we've initiated. To install general service counters at Tusong centers, and that was really to provide a single point of entry for citizens to come in, because typically in these Tusong centers it's not very clear where they should go, how they should access, and if there's no department there, how do they access services related to those departments. So that was the rationale behind providing a general service counter, which would then be the single point of entry. And it's also linked to a concept that is used widely in many countries where they say no wrong door. A citizen should never be turned away from a government department. And what typically happens in South Africa, if you go to the Department of Home Affairs, when you should be going to social development, sorry, you're in the wrong. In fact, you can go to Home Affairs for Home Affairs, and you can still be in the wrong department, and you get sent to another department because, sorry, we don't provide that service here. So it's around the concept of no wrong door, but clearly we don't have the sophistication, we don't have the maturity in terms of the evolution of service delivery in South Africa. And the general service counter is part of that evolution, if you like, to provide that single point of entry and the assistance to citizens, especially in rural and remote areas. The Tusong Center in an urban mall is really a flagship around the single public service, and it integrates national, provincial and local government services in a one-stop shop. And the pilot that the department has initiated is often referred to as the Maponya Mall, because this is a mall in Soweto where the first Tusong Center is being deployed. Members, I think some of this detail is fairly technical, but I would like to maybe just go to the next slide, please. Under the old administration, there was a different configuration of clusters, and we had what was called the FOSAD-ISAD cluster. ISAD referring to Information Society and Development. And under the ISAD cluster, there were eight committees, and one of the committees was the committee that deals with e-government. The DPSA, as part of that e-government committee, was then tasked with developing the blueprint for connectivity. And the departments that comprised of that committee were very frustrated because they had been working with CETA for a number of years, but were unable to have the blueprint in place. So one of the first things that we did is we developed the blueprint for connectivity. Once the blueprint was developed, It was simply a piece of paper. But it needed to be deployed in order to test whether that blueprint would work and provide the function that was required. But there was no money to deploy this particular blueprint. And one of the decisions that we took within the DPSA to foster and to facilitate the acceleration of service delivery was to pay for the connectivity. And one of the things, members, I must just share with you, in the Tucson census, you might have 6 or 7 government departments. You'll have Home Affairs, you'll have Social Development, you'll have SASA, you'll have UIS, you'll have Labor, you'll have GCIS, you'll have... Now, if you're putting in a shared service, okay, it's more cost effective, because what that means is that every department doesn't have to bring in their own infrastructure. You've got 10 departments, you don't have 10 departments trying to put in their own infrastructure. So one infrastructure that's provided, so it's more cost effective. But how do you recover? Who pays? How do you allocate the cost? And this is one of the challenges when you have transversal or service delivery that cuts across different departments and also different spheres of government. Because you've got national, you've got provincial, you've got local government. And one of the things I was saying to the DG is that we don't have a sophisticated facilities management infrastructure to support the Tucson Center, which are, in my view, essentially an orphan child in government. So we then took the responsibility to pay for the infrastructure. We wrote to Cabinet, and we tabled the concern with Cabinet around this particular issue, and we also requested the establishment of what we call the transversal fund. Because even though it's taken us 10 years to deploy the shared service infrastructure, right? Now that we've deployed it, you've got to keep it working. And there are monthly costs that are associated with these data lines and with these communication lines that have been put in place. What you see on this particular slide is a list of the Tucson centers by province. So the numbers tend to change a little bit. And, you know, when we started working with the GCIS, I think we got a figure of 109, and then it went to 140, and then it went to 159. So sometimes these numbers just vary a little bit in terms of how many they are per region. But what you see here is the number per the site count per province. Within each province, where we have installed data lines, in each province where we have installed what we call a local area network or a land infrastructure, where there are building problems, and you see the total count, for example, is 20. And typically those are either temporary structures or structures where we cannot put infrastructure, where they're waiting, for example, for the site to be completed. And then what you see at the end column, telecom non-viable, are rural and remote areas where there is no terrestrial infrastructure. That means neither telecom nor Neotel have got the infrastructure to put in a data line. And then we are looking at alternative connectivity using DSAT, microwave, radio links, or some other form of connectivity. And each of these have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. I was also saying to the DG, unlike, let's say, a bank which has a blueprint of how its offices will look like, or even today, if you go to a Virgin Active gym, they've got a blueprint of how the Virgin Active should look like. The Tucson centers are at the mishmash. of different structures that have been inherited and that have been possibly rehabilitated to provide services. So when you go in, you've got to look at each site on a case-by-case basis. The connectivity budget, which members were interested in looking at, was provided. This is the cost for supporting 142 song centers on an annual basis for the period under review. The costs do tend to be really high. We have a problem with the cost of connectivity and the cost of communication in South Africa. The Tucson centers don't qualify also for the E-rate. And we have had discussions with the DOC. Because the DOC has a fund that is supported by the telecommunication operator. But the only two institutions that classify for this are education institutions and health institutions that qualify for this discounted fee. We've tried to get the Tucson centers to benefit from this particular fund. And these are discussions that are ongoing between DPSA, DOC, and ICASA. I just mentioned that because it might be an area that we want to consider, members, because I think that we have a problem. We talk about connected government. And today in South Africa, there are still government offices without a telephone line. And I'm not sure that you can deliver services without a telephone. Now, we came in, and my division came in on a very particular request that was to provide the connectivity to the Tucson centers. And I think that there has been concerns raised about the functionality of the Tucson. What we have certainly discovered is that technology is only one part of the issue. You have to look at the technology in connection with the people and the processes that support service delivery. And if you're not able to integrate those pieces, then you're not able to optimize your service delivery. What we've also said is that we want to do things one step at a time. A lot of departments have not taken up occupation in these centers because they say, well, we can't work there. There's no connectivity. Now we have a list of all the centers and all the departments that are there. And we have engaged with the departments to say, well, these are the Tucson centers we use. We do not have a service presence. We've provided the connectivity. Can you please make arrangements to take up that service presence as soon as possible? And we will work with you together with CETA to sort out any technical obstacles that prevent you from providing services in those areas. The general service council, honourable members, I think that we've done an audit on all the Tucson centers. Not all of them are able to accommodate the general service council. Where we can accommodate general service counters, we are putting a mechanism to deploy service counters to those particular Tucson centers. And I think the numbers are reflected in the slide, together with the financials on the service. So, if you can. I often complain to my staff that we are not in the business of providing furniture. We, as the government CIO, are responsible for IT, but it has become a responsibility that we've taken on. And it's also one of the projects that we hope to complete. It's another project that has gone on for 10 years, and at some point, this project must be completed. And that is the undertaking that we've made in taking responsibility for deploying and finalizing the installation of the Dental Service Council. the starting of the general service counters, again you can see that the support is coming from the Umsebomi Fund, and this really places challenges on government to work in a collaborative way. There is no one department that is solely responsible. There's no single point of responsibility which creates, I think, some of the problems that you have encountered in your visit to the center.
Okay, so
the Mapolya Mall, as I mentioned, is a flagship which combines the national, provincial, and local government in Soweto. The list of departments is provided, and I think that the launch that CC is on is March 2010. Again, what you have is a very interesting, the challenges that confront us as we work across the three spheres of government. So between government departments and across national government, provincial government, and local government. With local government, obviously, you know, we often have pushbacks because they are not part of the public service, and what are we doing in their municipality when we deploy some of these initiatives and some of these services. I think I can stop there and hand over to the next colleague, John, who will speak on the CDW program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister, Chair, DG, and all protocol of them. I'm going to talk about community development workers. DG has alluded to some aspects relating to the historical development of the program. But I just want to emphasize that the CDW program is very, very young, in the sense that it was announced in 2003. But the first cohort of community development workers were trained towards the end of 2004. So in essence, the program started operating in 2005. And just to mention that the Deputy Minister, Mr. Padayashi, is driving the program from a national. Thank you very much. As you can see, the CDW program is there to improve service delivery, intergovernmental coordination, interaction between government and community, and participatory democracy. The CDW program so far is the only program in government that stresses along the three spheres of government. And because it's a new program and evolving, there are a lot of lessons that are coming out in the experience. And at this stage, I can say that, or acknowledge that there are challenges facing the program, especially in terms of the operation at the municipal level. But to try to address these difficulties, we have embarked on the process of developing a policy. And you may ask a question, why are we only developing a policy now when the program started in 2005? When it was established, because it was an intervention, it was not really necessary at that stage to develop the policy immediately. But what happened in the process was the framework that was developed, such as the handbook for community development workers and the master plan to guide in the implementation of the program. But like I said, because it's evolving and we are learning from the program, the need to develop the policy is very crucial at this stage. What we have done is that there are two phases. The first phase of the policy development is complete. It was more in terms of developing a literature review. Of course, considering the fact that this CDW program is the first program of its nature in government. So we have completed the literature review. The second step is consultation, where we're going to all provinces to consult with various stakeholders in terms of finalizing the policy process. So far, we have completed 8 provinces. The only remaining province is Northwest. So the focus of the policy is on 4 areas. We're looking at the definition, the purpose, objectives, and roles and responsibilities of community development workers. We just said that at this stage, it's really necessary to review those. We are also looking at the institutional responsibility and accountability for the program. As I indicated at the beginning, the difficulty with the CDW is that it's operating within the 3 levels of government. The operation is at a municipal level, and as I've already indicated, that is where the problems are, especially in terms of the accountability of the program and reporting at that level. We are also looking at the accountability. The question is, should CDW report to civil society, and what is the political oversight in as far as the program is concerned? We are also looking at the skills training and development and career pathing for community development workers. And career pathing is very significant at this stage because since the program started in 2004, or started operating in NS in 2005, we have CDWs who've been in operation, so we need to look at their career pathing, and we hope that the policy development is also going to help us in as far as that is concerned. There are already issues emerging out of the policy process. And some of the issues, obviously, is funding, which is a major issue. There is funding made available to the program. The only problem is that the funding is not sufficient because almost 90% of the budget allocated goes for salary for community development workers, and about 10% is for operational matters. So we hope that with the policy, we will be able to look at that. In fact, we have a separate working group. So there's one group that is focusing on funding money for community development workers because we want to improve this area. The other emerging issue is in terms of supervision and management of CDWs. So we're hoping that the policy would also address that issue. Also, the area of training and the development of community development workers. There has been a working group that has already convened, and there's a proposal on the table, and that will be included in the policy framework. Just for information, we hope to finalize this process of policy development by December this year, and we are going to have a national agenda consultation where we will endorse the policy development. I just thought I needed to mention this process of policy development just to give information in terms of what is happening or what we are doing to address some of the challenges that have been identified in the program. The other area is we are looking at the finalization and implementation of community development workers master plan. I've already alluded to that master plan is one of the guidelines that has been developed. And because CDWs work with various stakeholders within government, the master plan is very instrumental in terms of identifying the relationship of CDWs in line with these other government programs and how the CDW can actually assist in terms of working with those various governments. So the master plan nationally is ready, and the 2 provinces, Eastern Cape and Western Cape, have completed their master plan. We're waiting for the other provinces to finalize their master plan because it's very important. It also highlights the priorities of government that CDWs need to be involved in. I've already alluded to the training and capacity of community development workers. Just to say that in partnerships, we're also working with the Indian government where community development workers are exposed to the development issues in India. And so far, we have managed to send over 70 community development workers to India for various training. And this started in around 2006.
So even this year we have sent some CDWs to India. And then the nonsense standard for community development workers, because of the nature of the program, we realize that, you know, the implementation of the program in provinces sometimes is not necessarily, shall I say, uniform. Of course, considering the various uniqueness of those provinces. So the nonsense standard would actually assist in terms of addressing those issues. But what is happening is that after the policy development is complete, then we will embark on the finalization of the long-term standard for the community development workers. This is the breakdown of the budget, so I'm not going to say much about this, as I've already indicated that the bulk of the budget goes for salary for community development workers. And those that, the budget that goes for operations is not very much sufficient, and we will address it in the funding models that we are working on right now. And then these are the figures for the 2010 and 2011, about 3 million set aside for community development workers. And I must just clarify that this is more for the coordinating unit that is within the DPSA. It's not for the entire budget for community development workers, because at the moment, provinces are responsible for the budget of community development workers in their area. So this is just for national. And then for 2011-2012, it's about 3 million six. And then 2012-2013, it's about 3.695. So this is as far as the community development workers program is concerned. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to ask Rulani Makubane to take us through the gender mainstreaming and disability part of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, DJ, and thank you to the honorable members. During the introduction, the lady indicated that the strategic framework for both gender and disability has been developed, and we started implementing as from the 1st of April 2009. In terms of the program objectives for gender, we want to ensure a transformed, non-discriminatory, and fully inclusive public service which reflects the constitutional values of non-sexism and non-racialism. And for disability, we want to advance an effective enabling environment within the public service through the adoption of progressive policies, establishment of relevant institutional mechanisms, and development of key operational processes to ensure a transformed, non-discriminatory, and fully inclusive public service. I just want to emphasize before I go forward that we have to align ourselves with the new mandate of the Department of Women and Children and Persons with Disabilities that has just been established. And in terms of, you know, capacitating public servants, we actually want to we work very closely with Panama on action learning with regard to the gender and also the job access strategy framework. In terms of the projects that we have planned in 2010-2011, the first one is monitoring the implementation of gender equality strategy framework, where we will be doing organizational readiness assessments on the implementation of the strategy, and also doing gender audits and capacity development for implementers, and we will also provide quarterly reports. On the implementation of the Public Service Women Management Week and Institutional Change Management, this is actually informed by what we had in 2007. In 2007, during the roundtable on Heads of Department Roundtable on Gender Mainstreaming, there was a suggestion that we have a Public Service Women Management Week, one week dedicated to that in August of every year. We started implementing that last year in 2008, and this year was the second year that we implemented this. So what we're going to do is to engage gender focal points and also departments to engage on this, and also to ensure that our gender sensitive programs that go on, and we work collaboratively with the Ministry of Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities regarding this. In terms of the disability management or disability
The first thing that we have planned is the development of policy on reasonable accommodation and assistance devices in the public service. And the reason why we want to do that is that when we consulted on the job access strategic framework, we realized that departments have different understandings in terms of provision of reasonable accommodation measures and also assistive devices. So we want to develop a policy so that we can have a uniformity of application in terms of provision of this measure. And we will also continue to monitor the implementation of the job access strategic framework, where we will conduct stability audits and also capacity development for implementers of the job access. And then the next project that we want to do is the establishment of the Public Service Disability Forum, working very closely with the ministry as I've indicated, and also consulting departments in terms of finalizing the terms of reference so that the disability forum can be established. And this will serve as an advisory body for disability matters within the public service. And the other thing that we'll be doing is the disability awareness programs and the establishment of working relationships with disabled people's organizations. The reason why we want to focus on that is that often when we talk to departments in terms of recruiting persons with disabilities, they often indicate that they cannot get, you know, a sizable number of people that they can recruit. We want to work very closely so that closely with DPOs, so that we can have a pool of suitably qualified people with disabilities that can be recruited into certain positions so that we can work towards meeting the target. And in terms of the budget for disability management and for diversity management, both gender and disability, for next year we have 1.726 million, and then the next year 1.120, and the other year 1.075.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Chairperson. Briefly, in conclusion, just to emphasize that we are prioritizing these programs that have been identified by the committee, and corruption, the two strong centers, the CDWs, and the gender and disability program. We have determined a program of action with budget, time frame for these particular programs, but then just to emphasize that we are in the process of finalizing our estimates of national expenditure, and from there we will finalize our operational plan early next year. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I have thanks to the department and the presentation. It has covered areas for the program of action. I will just turn up from members in terms of issues that they want to raise. But amongst other things, DG, something that one wanted to find out is that, particularly cooperation from other departments, do we really get departments submitting their organograms? Have all of them cooperating with us? You know, all areas where the departments are supposed to submit. I think it's very critical for us to know. And then the other issue would be the contracts of the HOTs. I'm sure we definitely need clarity there. But I'll also open up for other members if there are issues they want to raise. Thank you. Honorable Sanskrit Vake, followed by Honorable Takim.
I want to raise an issue in which concerns the digital centers. As you mentioned, we went on a very interesting oversight visit in October. It was really a privilege for me to visit my digital centers because I can see the importance and the sense of bringing government departments closer to the people. We also recognized that there were still a lot of problems which got to be addressed. I just want to say one thing. I don't know whether Michelle will be able to assist me with that. And also the minister, who could possibly respond. My colleague from the Democratic Alliance and I were very annoyed when we visited the Tucson Center at Khaleshewe in Kimberley, which was a very well-organized Tucson Center, I thought. But at the end, well, we ended our visit by seeing that there was a constituency office of a political party as part of the Tucson thing. And we could not understand that. It had, on its office, it had a logo from the Northern Cape province, and then the party's logo next to each other. And we asked some questions. The Tucson Center at Khaleshewe is being funded from the office of the Premier. We asked whether the party pays electricity, pays water, pays for services, and the person said to us no. In other words, the office is for free and the services are for free. Now my question is, it's not a government department, it's not a NGO, is it a community-based organization, or what is the motivation for allowing a political party to have its constituency office at the Tucson Center? And this way I want to ask the minister, what is the government's policy in connection with differentiating between the state and a party? Because there's a problem, and we identify that. Thank you very much, Chair. That was the issue I wanted to raise.
Okay. Thanks, Honourable Francois. Honourable Patin.
My question here is in relation to DPSA as a department and the one public service issue. Do you not think that some of your frustrations will be alleviated if you can start looking in the direction of this one public service issue? And if so, how far are the processes in relation to that? Because I get the feeling that things are very tattered in here as a whole and very decentralized. As a result, there's a wastage in terms of funding. And it somehow gives me the picture that if you could have concentrate more on this one public service issue in relation to DPSA, wouldn't things be perhaps a little better? I don't know. Then the other question I have, there was a blueprint that was mentioned in terms of the development in rural areas. Can we get documentation on that? Not necessarily today, of course, but why I'm saying so is that perhaps we might need a picture or an understanding, an improved understanding as to the issues contained in that blueprint to can get better direction in terms of the committee now to perhaps come up with improved ideas to get established in rural areas. If we at least have an understanding of the blueprint, then we might be able to carry more weight in relation to what needs to be done there. The other issue is, I heard you mentioning in terms of your challenges in connectivity, ICT, information, and communication technology. You have problems there in terms of your e-rate or something like this. Do you have a relationship with the CETA, and if so, what is that relationship? And how effective is that relationship, CETA, SITA?
how influential, or rather how, what has been basically what has been done so far to assist DPSA get the proper connectivity. I just want to get a picture as to how involved are you with the CETA, relevantly involved with the CETA. The other question is, you mentioned that for your staffing, part of your funding comes from Umsobomvu funding. What I want to ask there is, how come? That you should put it better, because don't you have an HRM department which you should be paying staff, and don't you have a budget to pay for your staff? Why Umsobomvu funding? I just want to get an understanding and clarity around that. And then, with the CDW programs, you mentioned something about the DPSA being responsible with COCTA, and the fact that some of the CDWs are actually allocated to municipalities, isn't it? Now, what I want to know is this not affecting performance or affecting the actual message that's supposed to be brought about in the effectiveness of those CDWs? And if so, what's been done about it so far? Because the fact that you can't actually identify one office for them that they emanate from is making me wonder as to their real value in the service, if it's been really effective, because they have a lot of frustration that they would normally share in terms of operational issues and their packages, especially of what has been promised. So if they are not really allocated to an office, what's being done in relation to improving that? Then the model that you talked about in terms of them attending a program, a master plan program, I think you said, in India. What are you guys doing to ensure that if it's such a fancy model or such a effective model, what has been done to make sure that it's implemented within the country when they get back? Or what feedback mechanisms have been put into place or used to make sure that that is implemented or outsourced within the department? To actually give it as an example model to implement within our own country, if it's so effective, or if it's so such a master plan as you're naming it. The other thing about the gender, or the, at least the disability program, I noticed that the presenter was, you kept on saying we will 2010, 2011. Now, I'm just asking myself, were these not departments that were already existing in government? Because if I'm not mistaken, there was something about the office status, office in the status of women and disability. What has been happening all along that there's no connectivity in this program? Where if we are going to say now that we will still do this, we will still do this, or we project these projects, what has been happening previously? Is that not part of a continuity in the programs that have been there in the past towards this year? Because I would have thought that part of the reporting now would be telling us of what has been achieved in terms of the past financial year. For example, 2008-09, we would have thought we were going to get something out of that. But now it sounds like it's a totally new issue just because there's a new ministry. But those are offices that existed, I think, from the premier's offices in the provinces. Is there no connectivity, or are you now a totally new wing with totally new ideas and a disappearance of the previous year's work? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you,
what I want to talk about is the two Tucson centers and CDWs. Now, we went on this trip to two Tucson centers, and basically every department we spoke to said it wasn't their responsibility. So, fundamentally, one of the biggest problems is there's no management of two Tucson centers. In fact, somebody managing and coordinating departments to deliver the service to the community that they're in. Departments are saying, no, it's not us, it's them, it's not, and then when you ask that other department, no, it's not us, it's them, and this is chaos and mayhem, actually. Also, the same exists with CDWs. Now, we were lucky when we went to these two song centers to engage with CDWs as well, who also have the same problem. But they fundamentally felt like they were abandoned by government, and they just had to sort of like make their own way and try to service the community the best that they could without resources. And fundamentally, they had to report to everybody and be accountable to everybody, but they weren't given management direction. And somewhere, somehow, the DPSA must step up to the plate here and take responsibility, even if it's not their responsibility, but they must establish who's responsible for Tucson centers and who's responsible for CDW. Thank you.
Okay. I'm leaving it up to you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm sure the Deputy Minister would like to come in. I'm not sure if he would like to come in first or after we have responded.
At the end.
Protocol. Okay, now thank you very much. I'll also allow my colleagues to engage here. But maybe to indicate that the issue of cooperation from other departments, I think, is very uneven. We have brought the matter to the portfolio committee that we have a serious challenge around compliance with various prescripts. You highlighted the issue of organograms in particular. We have Colette Clark here, who is responsible for this area of work. She might want to comment in a minute. And also maybe comment on the process we're going through in terms of restructuring of government, the creation of new ministries, departments, because that's an area where this organogram is concurrent by the Minister for Public Service is very pertinent currently. On the contracts of HODs, I'm not sure exactly how you want us to engage that matter, but I'm sure you have engaged with the Commission or are aware of the Commission's report on the turnover rate of heads of department. Of course, that research was conducted in relation to the transition of 2004, but it did show that in the immediate period after an election, there is a high turnover rate of HODs. So perhaps that information in terms of the current situation that we could send to you early next week or late this week, just to give you a factual picture of the current situation in terms of the turnover. But again, it's Colette's area that she's responsible for, so she might also want to comment on that. I think clearly the Honourable Van Schalkwyk has picked up a problem. I think the Deputy Minister is going to comment on that. Maybe Michelle would also like to comment on that. I suppose, as she indicated, at very minimum one would expect that there would be payment for rent or the lease or whatever for that particular office. But I think that is clearly a problem that has been picked up. I think Honourable Bikani asks a very fundamental question around the single public service. Let me briefly say as follows, that we had developed a draft bill which was introduced into Parliament in June of 2008, but it was later withdrawn for two main reasons. The one was around the issue of consultation, that certain stakeholders had expressed concerns that there had been inadequate consultation, and the second was given the weight of that bill, there was a concern on the side of the committee that it was too rushed to try and process it before Parliament rose. So those were the two reasons why the bill was withdrawn. But I think What we obviously focusing on now is strengthening the consultation process, and in that process we would have to revisit the bill as well. But maybe just to indicate that there are certain constitutional challenges which militate against moving in the direction of centralization with respect to the single public service legislation. And what we had developed in terms of the bill was to actually maintain decentralization, but within a framework of norms and standards for human resource management, anti-corruption, IT, and so on, which would draw local government into a common system of public service. But I think certainly these matters will get debated going forward. I'm just trying to clarify in terms of the question. That decentralization certainly gives us challenges. And I think we're getting a very clear message both from Parliament and from Cabinet that we need to overcome these challenges and we need to be more assertive as the DPSA. It will be important, I think, when we finalize the bill to apply ourselves to this matter. I think part of the background which would be important just for the committee to be aware of is that when we amended the Public Service Act, and that was signed by the President at the time, end of 2007, beginning of 2008. In the process of finalizing those amendments, we have proposals which were to give the DPSA greater intervention powers, powers of investigation. But the input from the other stakeholders, specifically in this case, the Public Service Commission, led us to remove those aspects from the draft amendment to the Public Service Act because there was a feeling that we would then be encroaching on their territory. And I think it would be important for us to debate these issues going forward because in as much as we are gearing up, and we've indicated in the case of the AG report, for example, with the committee and cabinet, we are gearing up to be much more interventionist. There are limitations in the legal framework. So we want to be assertive, but we also want to ensure that we have the teeth to be more assertive. The amendment to the Public Service Act did give us additional powers, if you like, or requirements on reporting which strengthen our hand to some extent. But I think to operate in a way that would satisfy the kinds of questions that are being posed by the new parliament and the new administration, we would really need to look at how we draft that particular piece of legislation, which would enable us to ensure better compliance with the prescripts. I think the Honourable Williams raised an important matter. And it relates to the previous point I was making, that the DPSA needs to step up to the plate. I think we hear that and we recognize that we do need to. So it's not simply about telling the committee that GCIS is responsible and so on, but I think it would be important to share with the committee that a review has been conducted by GCIS on the Tucson Center. And this review was conducted in conjunction with the Technical Assistance Unit of the National Treasury. And certain proposals have been made around the championship of the program. Those proposals at this stage don't really have status because they haven't gone to cabinet. But I think in the interest of transparency, one could share that the proposals are that COCTA, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, would be the champions of the Tucson Centers. Whether or not in the cabinet deliberations it will go in that direction, one cannot say. But I think that it's important that the committee be aware that this work has been done. And I'm sure at some point the proposals will go to cabinet. But I think certainly when it comes
to the CDWs, and I'm sure the Deputy Minister would also want to comment. We are certainly feeling the need for us to assert our central role in order to deal with a number of the challenges. I think when our Florence spoke to the budget, the overall budget, it did indicate that most of the budget for CEWs is going to salary, but the operational requirements and support required by CEWs is very much inadequate, and hence the statement by the honourable members that the CEWs felt that they have been abandoned by government. And I think we obviously need to address that. And again, it comes to the weight of the central directive, as it were, from the DPSA within the decentralized environment. But certainly we note that need, and I'm sure the Deputy Minister will comment on that. So perhaps Colette could respond to your questions as well, Chairperson, to add something. And then I'm sure Michelle will talk to the questions that were raised around the blueprints, the relationship with CETA, the Umsobomvu funding. Florence will look at the CDWs. Andrew Liney will also talk about the gender issues. Thank you.
Yeah, can you proceed?
Thanks, honourable members. Thank you very much. In terms of organizational structures, with regard to compliance, we have an arrangement with the Auditor General, and we have requested them when they are doing audits if there's any evidence that line departments have restructured without following the first procedures in terms of the directives that have been sent out. They need to flag that in the report of that particular department. We departments submitting particular organizational structure to us, they are required to submit the first three tiers of the management position. What we look for is whether they are aligned to the proclamation in terms of the functions that were aligned to that minister in the department. We also see if there's any duplications of functions in those structures. We also look at whether they are fulfilling their mandate in terms of what constitutionally was awarded to them, and also whether they have the budget in terms of the MTF to have the structures that they have got. Our minister then responds to each of those particular executive authorities, saying where we concur and where we don't concur. If they still go ahead and they implement those organizational structures, even though our minister has not concurred, the Auditor General then flags that to us. Because what we've asked the Auditor General to do is ask them for the letter of concurrence from our minister before they can implement those particular structures. So generally, we intervene before they actually implement. There have been instances where line departments, we check in the newspapers, where they advertise in posts, and we follow through whether those are part of their structures, especially if they are at the top layer. And normally that information is brought to our attention. But with regards to the macro organizing project, for all the departments and newly reconfigured departments, we have followed the procedure completely, and we've worked with the two, with the split that happened, with the departments, with the two executing authorities in terms of promulgation, and also in terms of the shifting of the functions, as well as the new organizational structures. We at the tail end of that particular project, the terminal date was the 31st of October, and there were still three outstanding structures from departments because they were still in final consultation, and we've given them an extension until the 15th of November. With regards to HOD contracts, those contracts actually are managed by the Public Service Commission in terms of the current legislative arrangement. We deal with the career incidences where there's a request for the extension of the contract of the HOD, or where there's a request for the termination or early determination of that contract. If it's with provinces, the Premier's offices handle those, but they consult with us. If it's for national departments, they consult directly with our minister. And therefore, as the DPS indicates, that information we can make it readily available. in relation to the status of the agency contract for all 146 departments. Thank you.
Okay, so. Are you coming, Lisa?
Yes. If I may respond to Honourable Member's comment, the short answer is I don't know. But I will definitely find out. I do want to explain that the presidency has established a governance model for the two complexes. And I think, as members have pointed out, it's a governance model that perhaps doesn't work as effectively as it can or should work. But there is a what they call a national intersectoral steering committee, a NISC. Then you have a PISC, provincial intersectoral steering committee, and a LISC, which is the local intersectoral steering committee, which coordinates the involvement of the different stakeholders. National Treasury, I know, I also found this very funny. But it is an established governance model to coordinate between the players in different spheres and across the spheres. So you can imagine the complexity of this. National Treasury worked with CBIS to develop a business plan, and there is a business plan for the Tucson Center, which includes the appointment of a center manager and initiatives and efforts to try to get revenue-generating projects, rentals from the center. One of the decisions that were made a long time ago was that in every Tucson center there would be a post office. And the post office has been one of the agencies that has been better than most. It's not present in every Tucson center, but it has a very high, I can give you the statistics on the Roman Williams if you like. We don't have to debate the issue too much, you know, there is a presence. And I've been to many of them where there is a presence. Most of the post offices are also connected using VSAT. So even in areas where government departments have not been able to connect via alternative means, the post office has been able to do so. The other, let's say, non-government agency has been banks and ATMs. The encouragement of banking institutions and ATMs to provide services. Partly it's provided through the post office, because the post office has a post bank, but there is also an attempt to get other agents to provide services. When it comes to the political constituency office, like I said, the short answer is I really don't. So I will make an inquiry. The centers were not just limited to government departments, there were a number of stakeholders involved. But of course, we have the challenge around the model and the charge model and how we recover for certain costs. I'll also allow the Deputy Minister to speak to those issues. When it comes to the relationship with Kita, yes ma'am, until a month ago I was the deputy chair of the Kita board. Not that it means that there's any more responsiveness in terms of service delivery. We have struggled to get the blueprint in place as well as the connectivity. But not all of it is Kita's fault. We also have challenges with the income centers, with the government department, and of course challenges with respect to funding of the committee. The provision, however, of the blueprint has been developed by Peter. I think we're on version 12. So the first blueprint, version 1, and since then we've gone through a number of iterations to improve the architecture of this deployment as well as the security for this particular implementation. With respect to Omsebonto, again the GCIS has a relationship with a number of different players, stakeholders in this deployment. The agreement, it seems, is that young people, learners, would be assigned to the General Service Council and would be trained to provide that specific function. So these are not staff of the DPSA. This is again an arrangement that GCIS has made with the Ontobogi Fund to use young people and train them to provide information to citizens. And that's why we have the relationship with the Ontobogi and the funding of those particular things. And then maybe just the last comment on the single public service. I think members are correct in identifying maybe two challenges. The one is the governance model, and the second one is the issue around the, I would say, the architecture for service delivery. And that's the challenge that we have and that we need to confront as a public service.
Florence.
Thank you. I'll start with the master plan. Just to clarify that a master plan is more of an instrument that we develop from our point of view to assist in terms of challenges that we're imagining in the implementation of the program. So the master plan is there to strengthen the coordination of the program, because as we know, CDWs are not confined to one department, but they have to work with various government departments, including working at the local level. So that is the purpose of the master plan. In terms of India, I mentioned India as an example of how we try to develop skills for community development workers. Members would realize that in order for one to qualify to become a community development worker, they have to go through a training of 12-month learnership program. CDW program employs ordinary members from a community, so that's why the learnership route was very critical. And we expect CDW to be multi-skilled. So after their 12-month training, they should go through continuous training in order for them to be able to cope with what is expected from them. So India, you know, when the program was established, India is one of the countries that has community development workers. So the model was drawn from India and, of course, with some from other developing countries. So the reason we allow CDWs to go to India is so that they can be exposed to the Indian development way of doing things. And then the other area is to try to assist in terms of developing their own skills. And this has been useful because when CDWs come back from India, they are able to employ whatever skills they have learned in India, and there are reports to that effect. And then in terms of you know, other problems relating to the location or office space for community development workers, when cabinet took a decision in terms of the implementation of the community development workers, of course, it introduced a new model. And all three spheres of government, each were given a role to play. In terms of national was requested to coordinate the program. So it's ourselves and COPTA that is responsible for coordinating the program. And obviously, we were given different responsibilities in that regard. And when it comes to the provincial level was requested to be the level where the program, you know, they were requested to employ community development workers and be responsible for resources such as salaries and operational matters of the community development workers. And in terms of the local government municipalities were requested to be the operational level for community development workers, as well as providing supervision of community development workers. But like I said, the program is relatively new. And as it is evolving, we are picking up challenges. And you know, we draw lessons from the model, the way it is operating. And that is why we embarked the policy route in order to address some of the challenges that we have identified. So I just wanted to share that information. Thank you. I just want to mention that when I talked about collaboration with the ministry, it's not to say that we never collaborated with OSW and OSDP. In the development phase of the strategic framework, the OSDP and the OSW were thoroughly engaged and involved. And I think the focus here, maybe it's because the presentation was saying for 2010-2011, brief after the project. That is why the engagement that we made was not reflected in the presentation. But we did thoroughly involve them, and there was a relationship going on, and it's still going on. And we'll still continue to engage them.
And the follow-up? How many?
Sorry?
Okay, I can say follow-up is not a problem, not to remember. And not really, because there's also another business that we have to actually run for before we close. But surely, I'm sure it won't kill us. Just follow up. How many? Honorable William, Honorable Muscovy, and Honorable Bikan.
Thanks, Chairperson. Quite frankly, I think that using an excuse that something is relatively new and we're going to learn our lessons as we go along is unacceptable. The situation with CDWs is critical. There are, as we sit here, there's municipalities, people on the ground are busy burning government buildings to the ground because of lack of service delivery. And the fact that you're going to use the excuse that things are relatively new, where it's been around for 4 years and operating, is terrible because, I mean, how long? What are you telling us? Are you telling us it's going to take us 10 years to get CDWs under control? Because by then there won't be CDWs. These protests are turning violent, and they're attacking government, and the community looks at CDWs as part of this government. So I think that to use that excuse is just completely, absolutely unacceptable. Furthermore, I'd just like to say that I've been to about 10 Tucson centers, and I've never experienced the post office services in any of them. So, yeah, I mean, and we went to Tucson centers that service, for instance, Alexandra in Johannesburg, and there was no post office services there, and that's a very big area to service, and there were no post office services there. So I think that perhaps they should relook at the post offices, where they're placing them. I'm sure they must exist, but I think they're in the wrong place, that they must be on the ground with the people. Thank you.
And that will be done.
Chairperson, I think on the issue of the one single public or the single public service, perhaps as a committee we might have to go back a bit and do a bit of homework. I think I'll engage on that at a different platform from what I was going to comment on. But what I do want to also still go back on is the issue of the CETA, where well, you are Honorable Michelle. When Michelle came up with an issue of CETAs, the reason why I was asking this question, I was more interested in, GCIS in particular has been there now for how many years? And part of their key areas of visibility should have been in terms of their connectivity in ICT. And that has never really been effective. I hear you mentioning also the post offices having been. I also somehow concur with Honorable Williams that there's nothing really visible in line with ICT connectivity. And the fact that you know for a fact that CETA does give a service to government in relation to that, and it's one of their key roles to make sure that there's connectivity in all these Tucson centers. Now, my question is, what I'm asking myself, out of all these years that we're running, is there absolutely nothing that of significance that can... Yes, it's theory that you're giving of what should be happening and what has been happening, but what has it done to effectively show that implementation processes are being eased, at community level in terms of the CETA? That's where I was going to with my question. But at any rate, thank you, Chair.
Honorable Councillor, take.
Thank you, Chair. No, I don't know what the Minister is going to respond to my question. I just want to say, I really do not think that political parties
belong to or should be at Tucson Centre. Tucson Centre is service delivery. And the service delivery of political parties is on a very different level than that of community. That's all I wanted to say. And if it is permissible, then surely all political parties should be held at Tucson Centre. Thank you.
Okay. I think we'll take to the Deputy Minister in terms of rounding up the discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm watching your time and trying to make sure that we stay on track for your committee meeting and give you time to deliberate as well. Now, I have very few comments to make except just to say a few things. I think that as we are looking at the program of the DPSA for 2010-2011, it's important, in my own view, to remind ourselves that I think that there are three strategic centers in the work of the DPSA for the current term. And my assessment is that these centers, three strategic centers of our work, reside in the area of service delivery improvement. Second area being human resource development in the public sector, so that we can improve the skills of the public service. And the third one being in the area of governance, so that we can ensure that we have an effective state machinery that makes a contribution in governance. Now, a lot of the work that we've discussed here today, particularly I want to focus on the Tucson service centers and the community development workers. They are an essential intervention mechanism that the DPSA has at its disposal to ensure that service delivery is improved in the state. Both these programs, when they were originally conceived, were conceived as service delivery intervention mechanisms to bring services of government closer to the people and to enable people to have access to government services. Now, most of the comments that the honorable members have made about both these programs are indeed quite accurate in the way they operate. And in the way they operate, they demonstrate a great amount of deficiency in the ability of these projects to give us the kind of quality of service and the readily accessibility to services that our people should have. So if there is an indictment on these programs that we would make without any degree of reservation, is that there are a number of shortcomings through the length of our experience in the program that is implemented there. But this is not to mean that the programs and projects in themselves are not extremely valuable weapons in our endeavor to bring services to the people. In my assessment and from the work I have done, and indeed from the work of the staff of the department, both the Tucson centers and the CDWs perform very well as service delivery instruments. I think that if you were in a meeting, which I was in a month ago, no, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, in Mpumalanga, when the height of the Standerton and Sakila protests were happening, I was in a gathering of about 200 CDWs trying to ascertain from them what has given rise to the unrest in Sakila. And you see this young lady who stood up, very vibrant, very dynamic, very revved up, the revolution was all inside her, and she stood up and she said, "We CDWs are the eyes and ears of the poor." We are the defenders of the people. And they explained that it was corruption in Sakila that caused the unrest. And that they saw this a month ago and were able to report to the project managers all the issues that have given rise to the unrest and the disturbances. And notwithstanding that, as a government we were not able to prevent it. So what they have told us is that CDWs do work as an early warning signal that things are not going right in government. What is at fault here is that we don't have our own governance processes operating efficiently, that we take in fact these reports seriously and act on them. So there are, like that, and the colleagues have identified a number of areas of weaknesses that we have identified in our work with CDW. And we can enumerate them, and there will be a lot of them. But you've heard them speak about it today, from institutional location to funding to career pathing to resourcing to poor management and governance and so on. But in our assessment, we found that all of these weaknesses arise from one single important element, and that is that the program has functioned under a guiding framework that has given discretion to the implementing authorities on how to implement the program. And as a consequence of which, there is such a great degree of diversity and variety in the way the programs are implemented in the provinces. It's unique in the sense that it straddles three spheres of government. It's a nationally directed program whose locus of responsibility is set in the provinces, but whose theater of operation is in the municipality. And so, if you leave the discretion to the provinces, who then devolves it to local municipalities, there are many municipalities, many different styles of work, and so they all implement these projects differently. And it has led to such a kind of mix-match of contradictions. And our work is to improve what we have, not to throw the baby with the bathwater out. And that's exactly what we have been doing. We have been trying to look at this problem, come up with what in our wisdom is a recommendation that the way to resolve this is to establish the operational guidelines for these projects at the level of policy, so that there is some authority that is more inscriptive, more directive on how these projects should operate over all these issues. And the attempt to formulate a policy is precisely to do that, to finalize and to take ourselves a step further from guiding frameworks to policy formulation that has to be implemented with some degree of consistency across the spheres, across the departments, and in the entirety of government. And we are about completing that first phase. In December, we will finalize the policy. And then we hope that that would give us the threshold into the next phase, which should take us into the early next year, which should be the accelerated implementation of that policy. Now, I want to close by saying that if you take your discussion on the Tusong centers and the CDWs, they bear the same degree of similarity with respect to the problem. You know, the ones I've talked about, governance and so on and so forth. So the challenge for us in the committee, and I think in the governance cluster in government, is for us to look at how do we engage in a partnership with these departments so that we can refine the model and improve it better, especially the implementation model of these programs. Because our focus must really be how can we best utilize these instruments to accelerate the improvement of services to our people. That must be the central question. And I think that the departments would certainly welcome the engagement by the committee on this particular matter, and would be very receptive to any suggestions that the honourable members may have. Now, in this regard, I think that going forward, there are two very important issues that will come up in the committee's reflections. Must come up. The one is that what do we do with these programs going forward with respect to its governing and its institutional location? And there has been always been this grey area of collaborative responsibility between two departments, TPSA and COCTA. And both of them sit in the governance cluster, which is led by this committee. So it's a matter that you must take to the governance cluster and try to get some view on what are we using as our model. Are we saying we are more in future going down the road where a single department must take the full responsibility and deliver, or do we want to further build this notion of an integrated partnership model of responsibility if we're going to work in a cluster? And if it is, then let's define this very, very clearly, because right now the thing is falling between the stools. Right now everybody believes DPSA is responsible for CDWs and Tucson centers, and poor old soul, DPSA is not responsible for it. But they have to bear the burden of that misunderstanding. But they do get burdened with the responsibility to make sure that there is a policy, that there should be a policy that guides the functioning of these institutions. And once it's incubated this policy, then it is the implementing department's responsibility to implement the project in terms of this policy that has been developed. So for both these projects, the Tucson centers and the CDWs, you're operating in a policy vacuum. There are merely operational guidelines. So that's why they're such a great... So that's the first one, is the model for governance and implementation responsibility going forward, whether it is a single department or whether there's an integrated way in which these responsibilities are executed, and the departments must then account for what they are doing. And I think it's the work of the cluster. And Honorable Bikane is very, I think, that my sentiments lie with her when she says that we have to look at this in a new paradigm now, because we're now talking about a single public service. And so all of these instruments that is created, which might fall under different departments, will have to function within a single public service vision. And the closer we get towards understanding that and applying it in the service delivery interventions, the better our people will be to get improved service. I must agree with Honorable Skalte that party political offices really operate from constituency offices. To some centers are service delivery points. But again, what she has observed in Khalishiwa might be a reflection of this problem that we are saying, where there are no norms and standards for governance nationally. So that might be the case where a decentralized management kind of understanding happens, where an office is given to a political party on some basis. But certainly it's not the norm, or it's not prevalent all over the country. So it might be just a variation which is geographically specific and having arisen for some reason or the other, but certainly, Michelle, you must look at that. I think Honorable Williams is quite correct when he makes the assertion that that we can't use the reason that it is new to say that is why we having to deal with all of these things. I think he's got his finger spot on the pulse when he says that the CDWs feel abandoned by government. they do. I can tell you, they feel as if they are the neglected children, thrown away, you know, left to their own devices. And I must give you the assurance, Madam Chair, that in every one of these gatherings that I've spoken as a deputy minister, and I've spoken to seven of them now, this is the first time in their life that they've had a minister talk to them and take an interest in their work, and I've tried to really, really give them the assurance that we have not abandoned them. I close my case.
Thank you very much to the department, Deputy Minister Roy Panek, especially also the closing remarks that actually point out to the direction where we really want to dwell much on. I must indicate that, of course, there's quite a lot that we have to do, and part of the responses and the discussions are starting to clarify where we have to go. Like I indicated, you know, at Deputy Minister, what I really want to say is we do appreciate as a committee part of the role that you yourself and the minister show in terms of interaction with Parliament. You know, most of the time we don't realize something until something else come along. You know, we talk about the cluster, which I'm sure the department knows that next week of students of this cluster meeting, which actually has all the chairpersons from other committees, including members of other committees, who are going to meet with the governance and monitoring class. So it's part of the issues that we're actually raising and part of the nation and integration that we're trying to actually work on. So once we had this meeting with other chairpersons, and they started to complain about ministers and deputy ministers not showing up, and you know, I realized that, oh, it's different, you know, it's just a strange problem for me, because I really don't know the kind of problem. I therefore want to indicate that I really appreciate that, at least amongst other things that other people raise, I don't have that issue to raise, because both yourself and the minister take keen interest in working with Parliament, and we want to encourage to continue to do that, so that you can lead the rest, you know, in terms of doing the right things, and, you know, because sometimes you can speak past each other, simply because there is no proper communication. I just really want to delve a bit about on next week's program, because I want the department to assist us in terms of this task that the Parliament has given us. Like the Deputy Minister indicated, of course we will be coordinating the cluster collusion, that is, it might be a name monitoring, governance and monitoring. Yes, so what is going to happen is that we are being encouraged to actually move within that line. I'm sure the Parliament did try it many times, but now they're very serious about it. So it's one process that will be quite massive, but which we need to really hold it, you know, handle it with all the necessary attention it deserves, because that's a process that will assist all of us in terms of moving forward. I'll just indicate some few things. I'll highlight, you know, amongst other things, key things that I think they might come up from this cluster. The committees that will be involved, members will remind me of others. We do have the committee for women, children, people with disability, that will be part of this. We've got the Auditor General's committee, we've got public accounts. COCTA will be part of this committee for next week, the 11th, on Wednesday. A public service ourselves and administration will be there. Ad hoc committee on planning will be part of this committee. Constitutional development as well. Public accounts, let's go back. So all of them will be there, and even there are some others like the rules committee that will be part of this. And so I'm actually saying, you know, ourselves, because it is the committee together with the department that is coordinating this, we would request particularly assistance from the side of the you know, of the department, yourself, Deputy Minister, and the Minister, together with the DG in terms of assisting with the line departments that constitute part of this cluster. and also I'm sure we can interact along the way in terms of the issues of the program. As this committee, we were lucky, we did have a structure of the framework, I still have it, of the governance and administration cluster that it was presented on the 16th of September. Part of it, there will be a requirement of this nature. But there will be additional issues, of course, because the other chairs, you know, when I discussed with most of them, part of the issues that are raised, it is, if I can take you through, they do talk about the issues that are raised by the Auditor General and the Public Safety Commission. You know, those issues will come up very clearly. So if we can be ready, you know, that is, you know, the civil servants that have, you know, a business with, that trade with public services as well. Those are the things that will definitely come because the issues that are there, there have been a motion passed and there was a discussion by the DA as well on those issues that will come. And then the issue of gender mainstreaming again, it will definitely come back again, you know, and disability. So it will come. Issues of Tucson and the Tucson centers together with CDWs, they will be there. So the other critical issue will be still not public safety. We might have to look at others, but we take it that this will be the beginning of an interaction that integrates a number of, you know, committees together with departments. We need to really give it the best attention that it deserves in order for it to lead us moving forward. Because even the visits by Parliament is no longer going to be done by individual committees. Committees are going to cluster depending on an issue to actually go for visits so that we pull all other areas and start to work not in silo but as Parliament. Of course, once one went through all these things, I realized that in terms of structuring the cluster, there might be discussion that is required between cabinet, departments, government departments together with Parliament in order for us to find one another. Those are some of the things that we'll actually look into. And what we actually know that you might be chaired by Home Affairs as well and so on. So those are the things that we can sort of look along while we grow in this arrangement. But basically, if we don't handle it well, that's a reflection between Public Service Administration and its committee. So that assistance is required because we all need it in terms of taking it forward. Basically, that's what I wanted to just highlight. We'll be in a bigger venue because it's all committees coming together. We will be advised by the department how many people from departments and how is it going to be conducted and the format so that all of us get ready in terms of taking it forward. And we appreciate the interaction. We will keep growing. We'll keep really wanting to find one another. We'll be fast on other things as expected. But we really appreciate the fact that once we raise issues, for example, once we highlight things, we find that the department is always willing to respond and does its best to actually respond to the committee. And we hope we'll go along that way. I don't know if members want to raise any other thing, but on my side, I think that is all for today. Mm-hmm. Okay, we can. Thank you very much. And let's meet next week in the class.
I want to be aware, apologize for your presence.